Sedan as the place of combat. Fondille, who was a bad swordsman, was anxious to avoid an encounter with Daguerre, who was one of the most expert men of the age. But the council authoritatively commanded that he should fight or be degraded from all his honors. Daguerre appeared in the field attended by François de Vendôme, Count de Chartres, while Fondille was accompanied by the Duke of Nevers. Fondille appears to have been not only an inexpert swordsman, but a thorough coward, one who, like Cowley, might have heaped curses on the man, death's factor sure, who brought dire swords into this peaceful world. On the very first encounter, he was thrown from his horse, and, confessing on the ground all that his victor required of him, slunk away ignominiously from the arena. One is tempted to look upon the death of Henry II as a judgment upon him for his perjury in the matter of dueling. In a grand tournament instituted on the occasion of the marriage of his daughter, he broke several lances in encounters with some of the bravest knights of the time. Ambitious of still further renown, he would not rest satisfied until he had also engaged the young Count de Montgomery. He received a wound in the eye from the lance of his antagonist, and died from its effects shortly afterwards, in the 41st year of his age. In the succeeding reigns of Francis II, Charles IX, and Henry III, the practice of dueling increased to an alarming extent. Duels were not rare in the other countries of Europe at the same period, but in France they were so frequent that historians, in speaking of that age, designate it as l'époque de la fureur des duels. The Parliament of Paris endeavored, as far as in its power lay, to discourage the practice. By a decree dated the 26th of June, 1559, it declared all persons who should be present at duels, or aiding and abetting in them, to be rebels to the king, transgressors of the law, and disturbers of the public peace. When Henry III was assassinated at Saint-Cloud in 1589, a young gentleman named Lille Marivaux, who had been much beloved by him, took his death so much to heart that he resolved not to survive him. Not thinking suicide an honorable death, and wishing, as he said, to die gloriously in revenging his king and master, he publicly expressed his readiness to fight anybody to the death who should assert that Henry's assassination was not a great misfortune to the community. Another youth of a fiery temper and tried courage named Marolles took him at his word, and the day and place of the combat were forthwith appointed. When the hour had come and all were ready, Marolles turned to his second and asked whether his opponent had a casque or helmet only, or whether he wore a salade or headpiece. Being answered a helmet only, he said gaily, "So much the better, for, sir, my second, you shall repute me the wickedest man in all the world, if I do not thrust my lance right through the middle of his head and kill him." Truth to say, he did so at the very first onset, and the unhappy Lille Marivaux expired without a groan. Brantôme, who relates this story, adds that the victor might have done as he pleased with the body, cut off the head, dragged it out of the camp, or exposed it upon an ass, but that being a wise and very courteous gentleman, he left it to the relatives of the deceased to be honorably buried, contenting himself with the glory of his triumph, by which he gained no little renown and honor among the ladies of Paris. On the accession of Henry IV, that monarch determined to set his face against dueling. But such was the influence of early education and the prejudices of society upon him that he never could find it in his heart to punish a man for this offense. He thought it tended to foster a warlike spirit among his people. When the chivalrous Crequi demanded his permission to fight Don Philippe de Savoir, he is reported to have said, "Go, and if I were not a king, I would be your second." It is no wonder that when such was known to be the king's disposition, his edicts attracted but small attention. A calculation was made by Monsieur de Lomigny, in the year 1607, that since the accession of Henry in 1589, no less than 4,000 French gentlemen had lost their lives in these conflicts, which for 18 years would have been at the rate of 4 or 5 in a week, or 18 per month. Sully, who reports this fact in his memoirs, does not throw the slightest doubt upon its exactness, and adds that it was chiefly owing to the facility and ill-advised good nature of his royal master that the bad example had so empoisoned the court, the city, and the whole country. This wise minister devoted much of his time and attention to the subject, for the rage, he says, was such as to cause him 1,000 pangs, and the king also. There was hardly a man moving in what was called good society who had not been engaged in a duel either as principal or second. And if there were such a man, his chief desire was to free himself from the imputation of non-dueling by picking a quarrel with somebody. Sully constantly wrote letters to the king in which he prayed him to renew the edicts against this barbarous custom, to aggravate the punishment against offenders, and never in any instance to grant a pardon, even to a person who had wounded another in a duel, much less to anyone who had taken away life. He also advised that some sort of tribunal or court of honor should be established to take cognizance of injurious and slanderous language and of all such matters as usually led to duels, and that the justice to be administered by this court should be sufficiently prompt and severe to appease the complainant and make the offender repent of his aggression. Henry, being so warmly pressed by his friend and minister, called together an extraordinary council in the gallery of the palace of Fontainebleau to take the matter into consideration. When all the members were assembled, His Majesty requested that some person conversant with the subject would make a report to him on the origin, progress, and different forms of the duel. Sully complacently remarks that none of the counselors gave the king any great reason to felicitate them on their erudition. In fact, they all remained silent. Sully held his peace with the rest, but he looked so knowing that the king turned towards him and said, "Great master, by your face I conjecture that you know more of this matter than you would have us believe. I pray you, and indeed I command, that you tell us what you think and what you know." The coy minister refused, as he says, out of mere politeness to his more ignorant colleagues, but being again pressed by the king, he entered into a history of dueling both in ancient and modern times. He has not preserved this history in his memoirs, and as none of the ministers or counselors present thought proper to do so, the world is deprived of a discourse which was, no doubt, a learned and remarkable one. The result was that a royal edict was issued, which Sully lost no time in transmitting to the most distant provinces, with a distinct notification to all parties concerned that the king was in earnest and would exert the full rigor of the law in punishment of the offenders. Sully himself does not inform us what were the provisions of the new law, but Father Matthias has been more explicit, and from him we learn that the marshals of France were created judges of a court of chivalry for the hearing of all causes wherein the honor of a noble or gentleman was concerned, and that such as resorted to dueling should be punished by death and confiscation of property, and that the seconds and assistants should lose their rank, dignity, or offices, and be banished from the court of their sovereign. But so strong a hold had the education and prejudice of his age upon the mind of the king that though his reason condemned, his sympathies approved the duel. Notwithstanding this threatened severity, the number of duels did not diminish, and the wise Sully had still to lament the prevalence of an evil which menaced society with utter disorganization. In the succeeding reign, the practice prevailed, if possible, to a still greater extent, until the Cardinal de Richelieu, better able to grapple with it than Sully had been, made some severe examples in the very highest classes. Lord Herbert, the English ambassador at the court of Louis XIII, repeats in his letters an observation that had been previously made in the reign of Henry IV, that it was rare to find a Frenchman moving in good society who had not killed his man in a duel. The Abbé Millot says of this period that the duel madness made the most terrible ravages. Men had actually a frenzy for combating. Caprice and vanity, as well as the excitement of passion, imposed the necessity of fighting. Friends were obliged to enter into the quarrels of their friends, or be themselves called out for their refusal, and revenge became hereditary in many families. It was reckoned that in 20 years 8,000 letters of pardon had been issued to persons who had killed others in single combat. Other writers confirm this statement. Amelot de Houssay, in his memoirs, says upon this subject that duels were so common in the first years of the reign of Louis XIII that the ordinary conversation of persons when they met in the morning was, "Do you know who fought yesterday?" And after dinner, "Do you know who fought this morning?" The most infamous duelist at that period was de Bouteville. It was not at all necessary to quarrel with this assassin, to be forced to fight a duel with him. When he heard that anyone was very brave, he would go to him and say, "People tell me that you are brave. You and I must fight together." Every morning the most notorious bravos and duelists used to assemble at his house to take a breakfast of bread and wine and practice fencing. Monsieur de Valençay, who was afterwards elevated to the rank of a cardinal, stood very high in the estimation of de Bouteville and his gang. Hardly a day passed but what he was engaged in some duel or other, either as principal or second. And he once challenged de Bouteville himself, his best friend, because de Bouteville had fought a duel without inviting him to become his second. This quarrel was only appeased on the promise of de Bouteville that in his next encounter he would not fail to avail himself of his services. For that purpose he went out the same day and picked a quarrel with the Marquis de Portes. Monsieur de Valençay, according to agreement, had the pleasure of serving as his second, and of running through the body Monsieur de Cavois, the second of the Marquis de Portes, a man who had never done him any injury, and whom he afterwards acknowledged he had never seen before. Cardinal Richelieu devoted much attention to this lamentable state of public morals, and seems to have concurred with his great predecessor Sully, that nothing but the most rigorous severity could put a stop to the evil. The subject, indeed, was painfully forced upon him by his enemies. The Marquis de Thémines, to whom Richelieu, then Bishop of Luçon, had given offense by some representations he had made to Mary of Médicis, determined, since he could not challenge an ecclesiastic, to challenge his brother. An opportunity was soon found. Thémines, accosting the Marquis de Richelieu, complained in an insulting tone that the Bishop of Luçon had broken his faith. The Marquis resented both the manner and matter of his speech, and readily accepted a challenge. They met in the Rue d'Angoulême, and the unfortunate Richelieu was stabbed to the heart and instantly expired. From that moment the bishop became a steady foe of the practice of dueling. Reason and the impulse of brotherly love alike combined to make him detest it, and when his power in France was firmly established, he set vigorously about repressing it. In his Testament Politique, he has collected his thoughts upon the subject in the chapter entitled Des moyens d'arrêter les duels. In spite of the edicts that he published, the members of the nobility persisted in fighting upon the most trivial and absurd pretenses. At last Richelieu made a terrible example. The infamous de Bouteville challenged and fought the Marquis de Beuvron, and although the duel itself was not fatal to either, its consequences were fatal to both. High as they were, Richelieu resolved that the law should reach them both, and they were both tried, found guilty, and beheaded. Thus did society get rid of one of the most bloodthirsty scoundrels that ever polluted it. In 1632, two noblemen fought a duel in which they were both killed. The officers of justice had notice of the breach of the law, and arrived at the scene of combat before the friends of the parties had time to remove the bodies. In conformity with the cardinal's severe code upon the subject, the bodies were ignominiously stripped and hanged upon a gallows with their heads downwards for several hours within sight of all the people. This severity sobered the frenzy of the nation for a time, but it was soon forgotten. Men's minds were too deeply imbued with a false notion of honor to be brought to a right way of thinking. By such examples, however striking, Richelieu was unable to persuade them to walk in the right path, though he could punish them for choosing the wrong one. He had, with all his acuteness, miscalculated the spirit of dueling. It was not death that a duelist feared, it was shame and the contempt of his fellows. As Addison remarked more than 80 years afterwards, death was not sufficient to deter men who made it their glory to despise it. But if everyone who fought a duel were to stand in the pillory, it would quickly diminish the number of those imaginary men of honor, and put an end to so absurd a practice. Richelieu never thought of this. Sully says that in his time the Germans were also much addicted to dueling. There were three places where it was legal to fight. Witzburg in Franconia, and Usbach and Halle in Swabia. Thither, of course, vast numbers repaired and murdered each other under sanction of the law. At an earlier period in Germany, it was held highly disgraceful to refuse to fight. Anyone who surrendered to his adversary for a simple wound that did not disable him was reputed infamous and could neither cut his beard, bear arms, mount on horseback, or hold any office in the state. He who fell in a duel was buried with great pomp and splendor. In the year 1652, just after Louis XIV had attained his majority, a desperate duel was fought between the Dukes de Beaufort and de Nemours, each attended by four gentlemen. Although brothers-in-law, they had long been enemies, and their constant dissensions had introduced much disorganization among the troops which they severally commanded. Each had long sought an opportunity for combat, which at last arose on a misunderstanding relative to the places they were to occupy at the council board. They fought with pistols, and at the first discharge, the Duke de Nemours was shot through the body and almost instantly expired. Upon this, the Marquis de Villars, who seconded Nemours, challenged Héricourt, the second of the Duke de Beaufort, a man whom he had never before seen. And the challenge being accepted, they fought even more desperately than their principals. This combat, being with swords, lasted longer than the first, and was more exciting to the six remaining gentlemen who stayed to witness it. The result was fatal to Héricourt, who fell pierced to the heart by the sword of de Villars. Anything more savage than this can hardly be imagined. Voltaire says such duels were frequent, and the compiler of the Dictionnaire d'Anecdotes informs us that the number of seconds was not fixed. As many as 10 or 12 or 20 were not unfrequent, and they often fought together after their principals were disabled. The highest mark of friendship one man could manifest towards another was to choose him for his second, and many gentlemen were so desirous of serving in this capacity that they endeavored to raise every slight misunderstanding into a quarrel, that they might have the pleasures of being engaged in it. The Count de Bussy-Rabutin relates an instance of this in his memoirs. He says that as he was one evening coming out of the theater, a gentleman named Bruck, whom he had not before known, stopped him very politely, and, drawing him aside, asked him if it was true that the Count de Tiange had called him, Bruck, a drunkard. Bussy replied that he really did not know, for he saw the Count very seldom. "Oh, he is your uncle," replied Bruck, "and as I cannot have satisfaction from him because he lives so far off in the country, I apply to you." "I see what you are at," replied Bussy, "and since you wish to put me in my uncle's place, I answer that whoever asserted that he called you a drunkard told a lie." "My brother said so," replied Bruck, "and he is a child." "Horsewhip him, then, for his falsehood," returned de Bussy. "I will not have my brother called a liar," returned Bruck, determined to quarrel with him. "So draw and defend yourself." They both drew their swords in the public street, but were separated by the spectators. They agreed, however, to fight on a future occasion, and with all the regular forms of the duello. A few days afterwards, a gentleman whom de Bussy had never before seen, and whom he did not even know by name, called upon him and asked if he might have the privilege of serving as his second. He added that he neither knew him nor Bruck except by reputation, but having made up his mind to be second of one of them, he had decided upon accompanying de Bussy as the braver man of the two. De Bussy thanked him very sincerely for his politeness, but begged to be excused, as he had already engaged 4 seconds to accompany him, and he was afraid that if he took any more, the affair would become a battle instead of a duel. When such quarrels as these were looked upon as mere matters of course, the state of society must have been indeed awful. Louis XIV very early saw the evil, and as early determined to remedy it. It was not, however, till the year 1679, when he instituted the Chambre Ardente for the trial of the slow poisoners and pretenders to sorcery, that he published any edict against dueling. In that year his famous edict was promulgated, in which he reiterated and confirmed the severe enactments of his predecessors Henry IV and Louis XIII, and expressed his determination never to pardon any offender. By this celebrated ordinance, a Supreme Court of Honor was established, composed of the marshals of France. They were bound, on taking the office, to give to everyone who brought a well-founded complaint before them such reparation as would satisfy the justice of the case. Should any gentleman against whom complaint was made refuse to obey the mandate of the Court of Honor, he might be punished by fine and imprisonment. And when that was not possible, by reason of his absenting himself from the kingdom, his estates might be confiscated till his return. Every man who sent a challenge, be the cause of offense what it might, was deprived of all redress from the Court of Honor, suspended 3 years from the exercise of any office in the state, was further imprisoned for 2 years, and sentenced to pay a fine of half his yearly income. He who accepted a challenge was subject to the same punishment. Any servant or other person who knowingly became the bearer of a challenge was, if found guilty, sentenced to stand in the pillory and be publicly whipped for the first offense, and for the second, sent for 3 years to the galleys. Any person who actually fought was to be held guilty of murder, even though death did not ensue, and was to be punished accordingly. Persons in the higher ranks of life were to be beheaded, and those of the middle class hanged upon a gallows, and their bodies refused Christian burial. At the same time that Louis published this severe edict, he exacted a promise from his principal nobility that they would never engage in a duel on any pretense whatever. He never swerved from his resolution to pursue all duelists with the utmost rigor, and many were executed in various parts of the country. A slight abatement of the evil was the consequence, and in the course of a few years one duel was not fought where 12 had been fought previously. A medal was struck to commemorate the circumstance by the express command of the king. So much had he this object at heart that, in his will, he particularly recommended to his successor the care of his edict against dueling, and warned him against any ill-judged lenity to those who disobeyed it. A singular law formerly existed in Malta with regard to dueling. By this law it was permitted, but only upon condition that the parties should fight in one particular street. If they presumed to settle their quarrel elsewhere, they were held guilty of murder and punished accordingly. What was also very singular, they were bound under heavy penalties to put up their swords when requested to do so by a priest, a knight, or a woman. It does not appear, however, that the ladies or the knights exercised this mild and beneficent privilege to any great extent. The former were too often themselves the cause of duels, and the latter sympathized too much in the wounded honor of the combatants to attempt to separate them. The priests alone were the great peacemakers. Bryden says that a cross was always painted on the wall opposite to the spot where a knight had been killed, and that in the street of duels he counted about 20 of them. In England, the private duel was also practiced to a scandalous extent towards the end of the 16th and beginning of the 17th centuries. The judicial combat now began to be more rare, but several instances of it are mentioned in history. One was instituted in the reign of Elizabeth, and another so late as the time of Charles I. Sir Henry Spelman gives an account of that which took place in Elizabeth's reign, which is curious, perhaps the more so when we consider that it was perfectly legal, and that similar combats remained so till the year 1819. A proceeding having been instituted in the Court of Common Pleas for the recovery of certain manorial rights in the county of Kent, the defendant offered to prove by single combat his right to retain possession. The plaintiff accepted the challenge, and the court, having no power to stay the proceedings, agreed to the champions who were to fight in lieu of the principals. The queen commanded the parties to compromise, but it being represented to Her Majesty that they were justified by law in the course they were pursuing, she allowed them to proceed. On the day appointed, the justices of the Common Pleas and all the council engaged in the cause appeared as umpires of the combat at a place in Tothill Fields, where the lists had been prepared. The champions were ready for the encounter, and the plaintiff and defendant were publicly called to come forward and acknowledge them. The defendant answered to his name and recognized his champion with the due formalities, but the plaintiff did not appear. Without his presence and authority, the combat could not take place. And his absence being considered an abandonment of his claim, he was declared to be non-suited, and barred forever from renewing his suit before any other tribunal whatever. The Queen appears to have disapproved personally of this mode of settling a disputed claim, but her judges and legal advisers made no attempt to alter the barbarous law. The practice of private dueling excited more indignation from its being of everyday occurrence. In the time of James I, the English were so infected with the French madness that Bacon, when he was Attorney General, lent the aid of his powerful eloquence to effect a reformation of the evil. Informations were exhibited in the Star Chamber against two persons, named Priest and Wright, for being engaged as principal and second in a duel, on which occasion he delivered a charge that was so highly approved of by the Lords of the Council that they ordered it to be printed and circulated over the country, as a thing very meet and worthy to be remembered and made known unto the world. He began by considering the nature and greatness of the mischief of dueling. "It troubleth peace, it disfurnisheth war, it bringeth calamity upon private men, peril upon the state, and contempt upon the law. Touching the cause of it," he observed, "that the first motive of it, no doubt, is a false and erroneous imagination of honor and credit. But then, the seed of this mischief being such, it is nourished by vain discourses and green and unripe conceits. Hereunto may be added that men have almost lost the true notion and understanding of fortitude and valor. For fortitude distinguisheth of the grounds of quarrel whether they be just, and not only so, but whether they be worthy, and setteth a better price upon men's lives than to bestow them idly. Nay, it is weakness and disesteem of a man's self to put a man's life upon such leisure performances. A man's life is not to be trifled with. It is to be offered up and sacrificed to honorable services, public merits, good causes, and noble adventures. It is in expense of blood as it is in expense of money. It is no liberality to make a profusion of money upon every vain occasion, neither is it fortitude to make a fusion of blood, except the cause of it be worth." The most remarkable event connected with dueling in this reign was that between Lord Sanker, a Scotch nobleman, and one Turner, a fencing master. In a trial of skill between them, his lordship's eye was accidentally thrust out by the point of Turner's sword. Turner expressed great regret at the circumstance, and Lord Sanker bore his loss with as much philosophy as he was master of, and forgave his antagonist. 3 years afterwards, Lord Sanker was at Paris, where he was a constant visitor at the court of Henry IV. One day, in the course of conversation, the affable monarch inquired how he had lost his eye. Sanker, who prided himself on being the most expert swordsman of the age, blushed as he replied that it was inflicted by the sword of a fencing master. Henry, forgetting his assumed character of an anti-duelist, carelessly and as a matter of course, inquired whether the man lived. Nothing more was said, but the query sank deep into the proud heart of the Scotch baron, who returned shortly afterwards to England, burning for revenge. His first intent was to challenge the fencing master to single combat, but on further consideration he deemed it inconsistent with his dignity to meet him as an equal in fair and open fight. He therefore hired two bravos who set upon the fencing master and murdered him at his own house at Whitefriars. The assassins were taken and executed, and a reward of £1,000 offered for the apprehension of their employer. Lord Sanker concealed himself for several days and then surrendered to take his trial, in the hope, happily false, that justice would belie her name and be lenient to a murderer because he was a nobleman, who on a false point of honor had thought fit to take revenge into his own hands. The most powerful intercessions were employed in his favor, but James, to his credit, was deaf to them all. Bacon, in his character of Attorney General, prosecuted the prisoner to conviction, and he died the felon's death on the 29th of June, 1612, on a gibbet erected in front of the gate of Westminster Hall. With regard to the public duel or trial by battle, demanded under the sanction of the law to terminate a quarrel which the ordinary course of justice could with difficulty decide, Bacon was equally opposed to it, and thought that in no case should it be granted. He suggested that there should be declared a constant and settled resolution in the state to abolish it altogether, that care should be taken that the evil be no more cockered nor the humor of it fed, but that all persons found guilty should be rigorously punished by the Star Chamber, and those of eminent quality banished from the court. In the succeeding reign, when Donald Mackay, the first Lord Ray, accused David Ramsay of treason in being concerned with the Marquis of Hamilton in a design upon the crown of Scotland, he was challenged by the latter to make good his assertion by single combat. It had been at first the intention of the government to try the case by the common law, but Ramsay thought he would stand a better chance of escape by recurring to the old and almost exploded custom, but which was still the right of every man in appeals of treason. Lord Ray readily accepted the challenge, and both were confined in the Tower until they found security that they would appear on a certain day appointed by the court to determine the question. The management of the affair was delegated to the Marischal Court of Westminster, and the Earl of Lindsay was created Lord Constable of England for the purpose. Shortly before the day appointed, Ramsay confessed in substance all that Lord Ray had laid to his charge, upon which Charles I put a stop to the proceedings. But in England, about this period, sterner disputes arose among men than those mere individual matters which generate duels. The men of the Commonwealth encouraged no practice of the kind, and the subdued aristocracy carried their habits and prejudices elsewhere, and fought their duels at foreign courts. Cromwell's Parliament, however, although the evil at that time was not so crying, published an order in 1654 for the prevention of duels and the punishment of all concerned in them. Charles II, on his restoration, also issued a proclamation upon the subject. In his reign, an infamous duel was fought, infamous not only from its own circumstances, but from the lenity that was shown to the principal offenders. The worthless Duke of Buckingham, having debauched the Countess of Shrewsbury, was challenged by her husband to mortal combat in January 1668. Charles II endeavored to prevent the duel, not from any regard to public morality, but from fear for the life of his favorite. He gave commands to the Duke of Albemarle to confine Buckingham to his house or take some other measures to prevent him from fighting. Albemarle neglected the order, thinking that the king himself might prevent the combat by some surer means. The meeting took place at Barn Elms, the injured Shrewsbury being attended by Sir John Talbot, his relative, and Lord Bernard Howard, son of the Earl of Arundel. Buckingham was accompanied by two of his dependents, Captain Holmes and Sir John Jenkins. According to the barbarous custom of the age, not only the principals but the seconds engaged each other. Jenkins was pierced to the heart and left dead upon the field, and Sir John Talbot severely wounded in both arms. Buckingham himself escaped with slight wounds, ran his unfortunate antagonist through the body, and then left the field with the wretched woman, the cause of all the mischief, who, in the dress of a page, awaited the issue of the conflict in a neighboring wood, holding her paramour's horse to avoid suspicion. Great influence was exerted to save the guilty parties from punishment, and the master, as base as the favorite, made little difficulty in granting a free pardon to all concerned. In a royal proclamation issued shortly afterwards, Charles II formally pardoned the murderers, but declared his intention never to extend in future any mercy to such offenders. It would be hard after this to say who was the most infamous, the king, the favorite, or the courtesan. In the reign of Queen Anne, repeated complaints were made of the prevalence of dueling. Addison, Swift, Steele, and other writers employed their powerful pens in reprobation of it. Steele, especially in The Tatler and Guardian, exposed its impiety and absurdity, and endeavored both by argument and by ridicule to bring his countrymen to a right way of thinking. His comedy of The Conscious Lovers contains an admirable exposure of the abuse of the word honor, which led men into an error so lamentable. Swift, writing upon the subject, remarked that he could see no harm in rogues and fools shooting each other. Addison and Steele took higher ground, and the latter in The Guardian summed up nearly all that could be said upon the subject in the following impressive words. "A Christian and a gentleman are made inconsistent appellations of the same person. You are not to expect eternal life if you do not forgive injuries, and your mortal life is rendered uncomfortable if you are not ready to commit a murder in resentment of an affront. For good sense, as well as religion, is so utterly banished the world that men glory in their very passions and pursue trifles with the utmost vengeance, so little do they know that to forgive is the most arduous pitch human nature can arrive at. A coward has often fought, a coward has often conquered, but a coward never forgave." Steele also published a pamphlet in which he gave a detailed account of the Edict of Louis XIV and the measures taken by that monarch to cure his subjects of their murderous folly. On the 8th of May, 1711, Sir Cholmondeley Deering, M.P. for the County of Kent, was slain in a duel by Mr. Richard Thornhill, also a member of the House of Commons. 3 days afterwards, Sir Peter King brought the subject under the notice of the legislature, and after dwelling at considerable length on the alarming increase of the practice, obtained leave to bring in a bill for the prevention and punishment of dueling. It was read a first time that day and ordered for a second reading in the ensuing week. About the same time, the attention of the Upper House of Parliament was also drawn to the subject in the most painful manner. Two of its most noted members would have fought had it not been that Queen Anne received notice of their intention and exacted a pledge that they would desist, while a few months afterwards two other of its members lost their lives in one of the most remarkable duels upon record. The first affair, which happily terminated without a meeting, was between the Duke of Marlborough and the Earl Pawlet. The latter and fatal encounter was between the Duke of Hamilton and Lord Moon. The first arose out of a debate in the Lords upon the conduct of the Duke of Ormond in refusing to hazard a general engagement with the enemy, in which Earl Pawlet remarked that nobody could doubt the courage of the Duke of Ormond. "He was not like a certain general who led troops to the slaughter to cause great numbers of officers to be knocked on the head in a battle or against stone walls in order to fill his pockets by disposing of their commissions." Everyone felt that the remark was aimed at the Duke of Marlborough, but he remained silent, though evidently suffering in mind. Soon after the House broke up, the Earl Pawlet received a visit from Lord Moon, who told him that the Duke of Marlborough was anxious to come to an explanation with him relative to some expressions he had made use of in that day's debate, and therefore prayed him to go and take a little air in the country. Earl Pawlet did not affect to misunderstand the hint, but asked him in plain terms whether he brought a challenge from the Duke. Lord Moon said his message needed no explanation, and that he, Lord Moon, would accompany the Duke of Marlborough. He then took his leave, and Earl Pawlet returned home and told his lady that he was going out to fight a duel with the Duke of Marlborough. His lady, alarmed for her lord's safety, gave notice of his intention to the Earl of Dartmouth, who immediately, in the Queen's name, sent to the Duke of Marlborough and commanded him not to stir abroad. He also caused Earl Pawlet's house to be guarded by two sentinels, and having taken these precautions, informed the Queen of the whole affair. Her Majesty sent at once for the Duke, expressed her abhorrence of the custom of dueling, and required his word of honor that he would proceed no further. The Duke pledged his word accordingly, and the affair terminated. The lamentable duel between the Duke of Hamilton and Lord Moon took place in November 1712 and sprang from the following circumstances. A lawsuit had been pending for 11 years between these two noblemen, and they looked upon each other in consequence with a certain degree of coldness. They met together on the 13th of November in the chambers of Mr. Orlebar, a master in Chancery, when, in the course of conversation, the Duke of Hamilton reflected upon the conduct of one of the witnesses in the cause, saying that he was a person who had neither truth nor justice in him. Lord Moon, somewhat nettled at this remark, applied to a witness favorable to his side, made answer hastily that Mr. Whitworth, the person alluded to, had quite as much truth and justice in him as the Duke of Hamilton. The Duke made no reply, and no one present imagined that he took offense at what was said. and when he went out of the room he made a low and courteous salute to the Lord Moon. In the evening General Macartney called twice upon the Duke with a challenge from Lord Moon, and, failing in seeing him, sought him a third time at a tavern, where he found him and delivered his message. The Duke accepted the challenge, and the day after the morrow, which was Sunday the 15th of November, at 7 in the morning, was appointed for the meeting. At that hour they assembled in Hyde Park, the Duke being attended by his relative Colonel Hamilton, and the Lord Moon by General Macartney. They jumped over a ditch into a place called the Nursery and prepared for the combat. The Duke of Hamilton, turning to General Macartney, said, "Sir, you are the cause of this. Let the event be what it will." Lord Moon did not wish that the seconds should engage, but the Duke insisted that Macartney should have a share in the dance. All being ready, the two principals took up their positions and fought with swords so desperately that after a short time they both fell down mortally wounded. The Lord Moon expired upon the spot, and the Duke of Hamilton in the arms of his servants as they were carrying him to his coach. This unhappy termination caused the greatest excitement, not only in the metropolis, but all over the country. The Tories, grieved at the loss of the Duke of Hamilton, charged the fatal combat on the Whig party, whose leader, the Duke of Marlborough, had so recently set the example of political duels. They called Lord Moon the bully of the Whig faction. He had already killed 3 men in duels and been twice tried for murder, and asserted openly that the quarrel was concocted between him and General Macartney to rob the country of the services of the Duke of Hamilton by murdering him. It was also asserted that the wound of which the Duke died was not inflicted by Lord Moon, but by Macartney, and every means was used to propagate this belief. Colonel Hamilton, against whom and Macartney, the coroner's jury had returned a verdict of willful murder, surrendered a few days afterwards and was examined before a privy council sitting at the house of Lord Dartmouth. He then deposed that seeing Lord Moon fall and the Duke upon him, he ran to the Duke's assistance, and that he might with the more ease help him, he flung down both their swords, and as he was raising the Duke up, he saw Macartney make a push at him. Upon this deposition, a royal proclamation was immediately issued, offering a reward of £500 for the apprehension of Macartney, to which the Duchess of Hamilton afterwards added a reward of £300. Upon the further examination of Colonel Hamilton, it was found that reliance could not be placed on all his statements, and that he contradicted himself in several important particulars. He was arraigned at the Old Bailey for the murder of Lord Moon, the whole political circles of London being in a fever of excitement for the result. All the Tory party prayed for his acquittal, and a Tory mob surrounded the doors and all the avenues leading to the Court of Justice for many hours before the trial began. The examination of witnesses lasted 7 hours. The criminal still persisted in accusing General Macartney of the murder of the Duke of Hamilton, but in other respects, say the newspapers of the day, prevaricated foully. He was found guilty of manslaughter. This favorable verdict was received with universal applause, not only from the court and all the gentlemen present, but the common people showed a mighty satisfaction which they testified by loud and repeated huzzas. As the popular delirium subsided, and men began to reason coolly upon the subject, they disbelieved the assertions of Colonel Hamilton that Macartney had stabbed the Duke, although it was universally admitted that he had been much too busy and presuming. Hamilton was shunned by all his former companions, and his life rendered so irksome to him that he sold out of the guards and retired to private life, in which he died heartbroken 4 years afterwards. General Macartney surrendered about the same time and was tried for murder in the Court of King's Bench. He was, however, found guilty of manslaughter only. At the opening of the session of Parliament of 1713, the Queen made pointed allusion in her speech to the frequency of dueling, and recommended to the legislature to devise some speedy and effectual remedy for it. A bill to that effect was brought forward, but thrown out on the second reading, to the very great regret of all the sensible portion of the community. A famous duel was fought in 1765 between Lord Byron and Mr. Chaworth. The dispute arose at a club dinner and was relative to which of the two had the largest quantity of game on his estates. Infuriated by wine and passion, they retired instantly into an adjoining room and fought with swords across a table by the feeble glimmer of a tallow candle. Mr. Chaworth, who was the more expert swordsman of the two, received a mortal wound and shortly afterwards expired. Lord Byron was brought to trial for the murder before the House of Lords, and it appearing clearly that the duel was not premeditated but fought at once and in the heat of passion, he was found guilty of manslaughter only and ordered to be discharged upon payment of his fees. This was a very bad example for the country, and dueling, of course, fell into no disrepute after such a verdict. In France, more severity was exercised. In the year 1769, the Parliament of Grenoble took cognizance of the delinquency of the Sieur Duchelat, one of its members, who challenged and killed in a duel a captain of the Flemish Legion. The servant of Duchelat officiated as second and was arraigned with his master for the murder of the captain. They were both found guilty. Duchelat was broken alive on the wheel and the servant condemned to the galleys for life. A barbarous and fiercely contested duel was fought in November 1778 between two foreign adventurers at Bath, named Count Rice and the Vicomte du Barry. Some dispute arose relative to a gambling transaction, in the course of which du Barry contradicted an assertion of the other by saying, "That is not true." Count Rice immediately asked him if he knew the very disagreeable meaning of the words he had employed. Du Barry said he was perfectly well aware of their meaning, and that Rice might interpret them just as he pleased. A challenge was immediately given and accepted. Seconds were sent for, who, arriving with but little delay, the whole party, though it was not long after midnight, proceeded to a place called Claverton Down, where they remained with a surgeon until daylight. They then prepared for the encounter, each being armed with two pistols and a sword. The ground having been marked out by the seconds, du Barry fired first and wounded his opponent in the thigh. Count Rice then leveled his pistol and shot du Barry mortally in the breast. So angry were the combatants that they refused to desist. Both stepped back a few paces, and then rushing forward, discharged their second pistols at each other. Neither shot took effect, and both, throwing away their pistols, prepared to finish the sanguinary struggle by the sword. They took their places and were advancing towards each other when the Vicomte du Barry suddenly staggered, grew pale, and falling on the ground exclaimed, "Je vous demande ma vie." His opponent had but just time to answer that he granted it, when the unfortunate du Barry turned upon the grass and expired with a heavy groan. The survivor of this savage conflict was then removed to his lodgings, where he lay for some weeks in a dangerous state. The coroner's jury, in the meanwhile, sat upon the body of du Barry and disgraced themselves by returning a verdict of manslaughter only. Count Rice, upon his recovery, was indicted for the murder, notwithstanding this verdict. On his trial, he entered into a long defense of his conduct, pleading the fairness of the duel and its unpremeditated nature, and at the same time expressing his deep regret for the unfortunate death of du Barry, with whom for many years he had been bound in ties of the strictest friendship. These considerations appear to have weighed with the jury, and this fierce duelist was again found guilty of manslaughter only, and escaped with a merely nominal punishment. A duel, less remarkable from its circumstances, but more so from the rank of the parties, took place in 1789. The combatants on this occasion were the Duke of York and Colonel Lennox, the nephew and heir of the Duke of Richmond. The cause of offense was given by the Duke of York, who had said in presence of several officers of the guards that words had been used to Colonel Lennox at D'Aubigny's to which no gentleman ought to have submitted. Colonel Lennox went up to the Duke on parade and asked him publicly whether he had made such an assertion. The Duke of York, without answering his question, coldly ordered him to his post. When parade was over, he took an opportunity of saying publicly in the orderly room before Colonel Lennox that he desired no protection from his rank as a prince and his station as commanding officer, adding that when he was off duty he wore a plain brown coat like a private gentleman and was ready, as such, to give satisfaction. Colonel Lennox desired nothing better than satisfaction, that is to say, to run the chance of shooting the Duke through the body or being shot himself. He accordingly challenged His Royal Highness, and they met on Wimbledon Common. Colonel Lennox fired first, and the ball whizzed past the head of his opponent, so near to it as to graze his projecting curl. The Duke refused to return the fire, and the seconds interfering, the affair terminated. Colonel Lennox was very shortly afterwards engaged in another duel arising out of this. A Mr. Swift wrote a pamphlet in reference to the dispute between him and the Duke of York, at some expressions in which he took so much offense as to imagine that nothing but a shot at the writer could atone for them. They met on the Uxbridge Road, but no damage was done to either party. The Irish were for a long time renowned for their love of dueling. The slightest offense which it is possible to imagine that one man could offer to another was sufficient to provoke a challenge. Sir Jonah Barrington relates in his memoirs that previous to the Union, during the time of a disputed election in Dublin, it was no unusual thing for 23 duels to be fought in a day. Even in times of less excitement, they were so common as to be deemed unworthy of note by the regular chroniclers of events, except in cases where one or both of the combatants were killed. In those days, in Ireland, it was not only the man of the military, but of every profession, who had to work his way to eminence with the sword or the pistol. Each political party had its regular corps of bullies, or fire-eaters, as they were called, who qualified themselves for being the pests of society by spending all their spare time in firing at targets. They boasted that they could hit an opponent in any part of his body they pleased, and made up their minds before the encounter began whether they should kill him, disable, or disfigure him for life, lay him on a bed of suffering for a 12-month, or merely graze a limb. The evil had reached an alarming height when, in the year 1808, an opportunity was offered to King George III of showing in a striking manner his detestation of the practice, and of setting an example to the Irish that such murders were not to be committed with impunity. A dispute arose in the month of June 1807 between Major Campbell and Captain Boyd, officers of the 21st Regiment, stationed in Ireland, about the proper manner of giving the word of command on parade. Hot words ensued on this slight occasion, and the result was a challenge from Campbell to Boyd. They retired into the mess room shortly afterwards, and each stationed himself at a corner, the distance obliquely being but 7 paces. Here, without friends or seconds being present, they fired at each other, and Captain Boyd fell mortally wounded between the 4th and 5th ribs. A surgeon, who came in shortly, found him sitting in a chair, vomiting and suffering great agony. He was led into another room, Major Campbell following in great distress and perturbation of mind. Boyd survived but 18 hours, and just before his death said in reply to a question from his opponent that the duel was not fair, and added, "You hurried me, Campbell. You're a bad man." "Good God," replied Campbell, "will you mention before these gentlemen was not everything fair? Did you not say that you were ready?" Boyd answered faintly, "Oh, no, you know I wanted you to wait and have friends." On being asked again whether all was fair, the dying man faintly murmured, "Yes." But in a minute after, he said, "You're a bad man." Campbell was now in great agitation, and wringing his hands convulsively, he exclaimed, "Oh, Boyd, you are the happiest man of the two. Do you forgive me?" Boyd replied, "I forgive you. I feel for you as I know you do for me." He shortly afterwards expired, and Major Campbell made his escape from Ireland and lived for some months with his family under an assumed name in the neighborhood of Chelsea. He was, however, apprehended and brought to trial at Armagh in August 1808. He said while in prison that, if found guilty of murder, he should suffer as an example to duelists in Ireland. But he endeavored to buoy himself up with the hope that the jury would only convict him of manslaughter. It was proved in evidence upon the trial that the duel was not fought immediately after the offense was given, but that Major Campbell went home and drank tea with his family before he sought Boyd for the fatal encounter. The jury returned a verdict of willful murder against him, but recommended him to mercy on the ground that the duel had been a fair one. He was condemned to die on the Monday following, but was afterwards respited for a few days longer. In the meantime, the greatest exertions were made in his behalf. His unfortunate wife went upon her knees before the Prince of Wales to move him to use his influence with the king in favor of her unhappy husband. Everything a fond wife and a courageous woman could do, she tried to gain the royal clemency. But George III was inflexible in consequence of the representations of the Irish viceroy that an example was necessary. The law was therefore allowed to take its course, and the victim of a false spirit of honor died the death of a felon. The most inveterate duelists of the present day are the students in the universities of Germany. They fight on the most frivolous pretenses, and settle with swords and pistols the schoolboy disputes which in other countries are arranged by the more harmless medium of the fisticuffs. It was at one time the custom among these savage youths to prefer the sword combat, for the facility it gave them of cutting off the noses of their opponents. To disfigure them in this manner was an object of ambition, and the German duelists reckoned the number of these disgusting trophies which they had borne away with as much satisfaction as a successful general the provinces he had reduced or the cities he had taken. But it would be wearisome to enter into the minute detail of all the duels of modern times. If an examination were made into the general causes which produced them, it would be found that in every case they had been either of the most trivial or the most unworthy nature. Parliamentary duels were at one time very common, and amongst the names of those who have soiled a great reputation by conforming to the practice may be mentioned those of Warren Hastings, Sir Philip Francis, Wilkes, Pitt, Fox, Grattan, Curran, Tierney, and Canning. So difficult is it even for the superior mind to free itself from the trammels with which foolish opinion has enswathed it. Not one of these celebrated persons who did not in his secret soul condemn the folly to which he lent himself. The bonds of reason, though iron strong, are easily burst through, but those of folly, though lithe and frail as the rushes by a stream, defy the stoutest heart to snap them asunder. Colonel Thomas, an officer in the Guards who was killed in a duel, added the following clause to his will the night before he died. "In the first place, I commit my soul to Almighty God in hope of his mercy and pardon for the irreligious step I now, in compliance with the unwarrantable customs of this wicked world, put myself under the necessity of taking." How many have been in the same state of mind as this wise, foolish man? He knew his error and abhorred it, but could not resist it for fear of the opinion of the prejudiced and unthinking. No other could have blamed him for refusing to fight a duel. The list of duels that have sprung from the most degrading causes might be stretched out to an almost indefinite extent. Sterne's father fought a duel about a goose, and the great Raleigh about a tavern bill. Raleigh, at one period of his life, appeared to be an inveterate duelist, and it was said of him that he had been engaged in more encounters of the kind than any man of note among his contemporaries. More than one fellow creature he had deprived of life, but he lived long enough to be convinced of the sinfulness of his conduct and made a solemn vow never to fight another duel. The following anecdote of his forbearance is well known, but it will bear repetition. A dispute arose in a coffee house between him and a young man on some trivial point, and the latter, losing his temper, impertinently spat in the face of the veteran. Sir Walter, instead of running him through the body as many would have done, or challenging him to mortal combat, coolly took out his handkerchief, wiped his face, and said, "Young man, if I could as easily wipe from my conscience the stain of killing you as I can this spittle from my face, you should not live another minute." The young man immediately begged his pardon. Scores of duels, many of them fatal, have been fought from disputes at cards or a place at a theater. While hundreds of challenges given and accepted overnight in a fit of drunkenness have been fought out the next morning to the death of one or both of the antagonists. Two of the most notorious duels of modern times had their origin in causes no more worthy than the quarrel of a dog and the favor of a prostitute. That between McNamara and Montgomery arising from the former, and that between Best and Lord Camelford from the latter. The dog of Montgomery attacked a dog belonging to McNamara, and each master interfering in behalf of his own animal, high words ensued. The result was the giving and accepting a challenge to mortal combat. The parties met on the following day when Montgomery was shot dead and his antagonist severely wounded. The affair created a great sensation at the time, and Heaviside, the surgeon who attended at the fatal field to render his assistance if necessary, was arrested as an accessory to murder and committed to Newgate. In the duel between Best and Lord Camelford, two pistols were used which were considered to be the best in England. One of them was thought slightly superior to the other, and it was agreed that the belligerents should toss up a piece of money to decide the choice of weapons. Best gained it, and at the first discharge, Lord Camelford fell mortally wounded. But little sympathy was expressed for his fate. He was a confirmed duelist, had been engaged in many meetings of the kind, and the blood of more than one fellow creature lay at his door. As he had sowed, so did he reap, and the violent man met an appropriate death. It now only remains to notice the means that have been taken to stay the prevalence of this madness of false honor in the various countries of the civilized world. The efforts of the governments of France and England have already been mentioned, and their want of success is but too well known. The same efforts have been attended with the same results elsewhere. In despotic countries, where the will of the monarch has been strongly expressed and vigorously supported, a diminution of the evil has for a time resulted, but only to be increased again when death relaxed the iron grasp and a successor appeared of less decided opinions on the subject. This was the case in Prussia under the great Frederick, of whose aversion to dueling a popular anecdote is recorded. It is stated of him that he permitted dueling in his army, but only upon the condition that the combatants should fight in presence of a whole battalion of infantry, drawn up on purpose to see fair play. The latter received strict orders, when one of the belligerents fell, to shoot the other immediately. It is added that the known determination of the king effectually put a stop to the practice. The Emperor Joseph II of Austria was as firm as Frederick, although the measures he adopted were not so singular. The following letter explains his views on the subject. To General Blank. My General, you will immediately arrest the Count of K and Captain W. The Count is young, passionate, and influenced by wrong notions of birth and a false spirit of honor. Captain W. is an old soldier who will adjust every dispute with the sword and pistol, and who has received the challenge of the young count with unbecoming warmth. I will suffer no dueling in my army. I despise the principles of those who attempt to justify the practice, and who would run each other through the body in cold blood. When I have officers who bravely expose themselves to every danger in facing the enemy, who at all times exhibit courage, valor, and resolution in attack and defense, I esteem them highly. The coolness with which they meet death on such occasions is serviceable to their country, and at the same time redounds to their own honor. But should there be men amongst them who are ready to sacrifice everything to their vengeance and hatred, I despise them. I consider such a man as no better than a Roman gladiator. Order a court-martial to try the two officers. Investigate the subject of their dispute with that impartiality which I demand from every judge, and he that is guilty, let him be a sacrifice to his fate and the laws. Such a barbarous custom, which suits the age of the Tamerlanes and Bajazets, and which has often had such melancholy effects on single families, I will have suppressed and punished, even if it should deprive me of one half of my officers. There are still men who know how to unite the character of a hero with that of a good subject, and he only can be so who respects the laws. August 1771. Joseph. In the United States of America, the code varies considerably. In one or two of the still wild and simple states of the Far West, where no duel has yet been fought, there is no specific law upon the subject beyond that in the Decalogue, which says, "Thou shalt do no murder." But dueling everywhere follows the steps of modern civilization, and by the time the backwoodsman is transformed into the citizen, he has imbibed the false notions of honor which are prevalent in Europe and around him, and is ready, like his progenitors, to settle his differences with the pistol. In the majority of the states, the punishment for challenging, fighting, or acting as second is solitary imprisonment and hard labor for any period less than a year, and disqualification for serving any public office for 20 years. In Vermont, the punishment is total disqualification for office, deprivation of the rights of citizenship, and a fine. In fatal cases, the same punishment as that of murderers. In Rhode Island, the combatant, though death does not ensue, is liable to be carted to the gallows with a rope about his neck and to sit in this trim for an hour exposed to the peltings of the mob. He may be further imprisoned for a year at the option of the magistrate. In Connecticut, the punishment is total disqualification for office or employ and a fine varying from $100 to $1,000. The laws of Illinois require certain officers of the state to make oath previous to their installment that they have never been nor ever will be concerned in a duel. Amongst the edicts against dueling promulgated at various times in Europe may be mentioned that of Augustus, King of Poland, in 1712, which decreed the punishment of death against principals and seconds, and minor punishments against the bearers of a challenge. An edict was also published at Munich in 1773, according to which both principals and seconds, even in duels where no one was either killed or wounded, should be hanged, and their bodies buried at the foot of the gallows. The King of Naples issued an ordinance against dueling in 1838, in which the punishment of death is decreed against all concerned in a fatal duel. The bodies of those killed and of those who may be executed in consequence are to be buried in unconsecrated ground and without any religious ceremony. Nor is any monument to be erected on the spot. The punishment for duels in which either or both are wounded, and for those in which no damage whatever is done, varies according to the case, and consists of fine, imprisonment, loss of rank and honors, and incapacity for filling any public situation. Bearers of challenges may also be punished with fine and imprisonment. It might be imagined that enactments so severe all over the civilized world would finally eradicate a custom, the prevalence of which every wise and good man must deplore. But the frowns of the law never yet have taught and never will teach men to desist from this practice, as long as it is felt that the lawgiver sympathizes with it in his heart. The stern judge upon the bench may say to the unfortunate wight who has been called a liar by some unmannerly opponent, "If you challenge him, you meditate murder and are guilty of murder." But the same judge, divested of his robes of state and mixing in the world with other men, would say, "If you do not challenge him, if you do not run the risk of making yourself a murderer, you will be looked upon as a mean-spirited wretch, unfit to associate with your fellows, and deserving nothing but their scorn and their contempt." It is society and not the duelist who is to blame. Female influence, too, which is so powerful in leading men either to good or to evil, takes in this case the evil part. Mere animal bravery has, unfortunately, such charms in the female eye that a successful duelist is but too often regarded as a sort of hero. And the man who refuses to fight, though of truer courage, is thought a poltroon who may be trampled on. Mr. Graves, a member of the American legislature, who early in 1838 killed a Mr. Silly in a duel, truly and eloquently said on the floor of the House of Representatives, when lamenting the unfortunate issue of that encounter, that society was more to blame than he was. "Public opinion," said the repentant orator, "is practically the paramount law of the land. Every other law, both human and divine, ceases to be observed, yea, withers and perishes in contact with it. It was this paramount law of this nation and of this house that forced me, under the penalty of dishonor, to subject myself to the code which impelled me unwillingly into this tragical affair. Upon the heads of this nation and at the doors of this house rests the blood with which my unfortunate hands have been stained. As long as society is in this mood, as long as it thinks that the man who refuses to resent an insult deserved that insult and should be scouted accordingly, so long, it is to be feared, will dueling exist, however severe the laws may be. Men must have redress for injuries inflicted, and when those injuries are of such a nature that no tribunal will take cognizance of them, the injured will take the law into their own hands and right themselves in the opinion of their fellows at the hazard of their lives. Much as the sage may affect to despise the opinion of the world, there are few who would not rather expose their lives 100 times than be condemned to live on in society, but not of it, a byword of reproach to all who know their history, and a mark for scorn to point his finger at. The only practicable means for diminishing the force of a custom which is the disgrace of civilization seems to be the establishment of a court of honor, which should take cognizance of all those delicate and almost intangible offenses which yet wound so deeply. The court established by Louis XIV might be taken as a model. No man now fights a duel when a fit apology has been offered, and it should be the duty of this court to weigh dispassionately the complaint of every man injured in his honor, either by word or deed, and to force the offender to make a public apology. If he refused the apology, he would be the breaker of a second law, an offender against a high court as well as against the man he had injured, and might be punished with fine and imprisonment, the latter to last until he saw the error of his conduct and made the concession which the court demanded. If, after the establishment of this tribunal, men should be found of a nature so bloodthirsty as not to be satisfied with its peaceful decisions, and should resort to the old and barbarous mode of an appeal to the pistol, some means might be found of dealing with them. To hang them as murderers would be of no avail, for to such men death would have few terrors. Shame alone would bring them to reason. Transportation, the treadwheel, or a public whipping would perhaps be sufficient. Relics. A foth old knick-knackets, rusty airn caps and jinglin' jackets, would han the Lothians 3 in tackets a toomand good, and parritch pots and old salt buckets afore the flood. Burns. The love for relics is one which will never be eradicated as long as feeling and affection are denizens of the heart. It is a love which is most easily excited in the best and kindliest natures, and which few are callous enough to scoff at. Who would not treasure the lock of hair that once adorned the brow of the faithful wife now cold in death, or that hung down the neck of a beloved infant now sleeping under the sward? Not one. They are home relics whose sacred worth is intelligible to all, spoils rescued from the devouring grave, which to the affectionate are beyond all price. How dear to a forlorn survivor the book over whose pages he has pored with one departed! How much greater its value if that hand, now cold, had written a thought, an opinion, or a name upon the leaf. Besides these sweet domestic relics, there are others which no one can condemn, relics sanctified by that admiration of greatness and goodness which is akin to love, such as the copy of Montaigne's Florio, with the name of Shakespeare upon the leaf, written by the poet of all time himself, the chair preserved at Antwerp in which Rubens sat when he painted the immortal Descent from the Cross, or the telescope preserved in the Museum of Florence which aided Galileo in his sublime discoveries. Who would not look with veneration upon the undoubted arrow of William Tell, the swords of Wallace or of Hampden, or the Bible whose leaves were turned by some stern old father of the faith? Thus the principle of relicism is hallowed and enshrined by love. But from this germ of purity, how numerous the progeny of errors and superstitions! Men, in their admiration of the great and of all that appertained to them, have forgotten that goodness is a component part of true greatness, and have made fools of themselves for the jawbone of a saint, the toenail of an apostle, the handkerchief a king blew his nose in, or the rope that hanged a criminal. Desiring to rescue some slight token from the graves of their predecessors, they have confounded the famous and the infamous, the renowned and the notorious. Great saints, great sinners, great philosophers, great quacks, great conquerors, great murderers, great ministers, great thieves. Each and all have had their admirers ready to ransack Earth from the equator to either pole to find a relic of them. The relicism of modern times dates its origin from the centuries immediately preceding the Crusades. The first pilgrims to the Holy Land brought back to Europe thousands of apocryphal relics in the purchase of which they had expended all their store. The greatest favorite was the wood of the true cross, which, like the oil of the widow, never diminished. It is generally asserted in the traditions of the Romish Church that the Empress Helen, the mother of Constantine the Great, first discovered the veritable true cross in her pilgrimage to Jerusalem. The Emperor Theodosius made a present of the greater part of it to St. Ambrose, Bishop of Milan, by whom it was studded with precious stones and deposited in the principal church of that city. It was carried away by the Huns, by whom it was burnt after they had extracted the valuable jewels it contained. Fragments purporting to have been cut from it were, in the 11th and 12th centuries, to be found in almost every church in Europe, and would, if collected together in one place, have been almost sufficient to have built a cathedral. Happy was the sinner who could get a sight of one of them, happier he who possessed one. To obtain them, the greatest dangers were cheerfully braved. They were thought to preserve from all evils and to cure the most inveterate diseases. Annual pilgrimages were made to the shrines that contained them, and considerable revenues collected from the devotees. Next in renown were those precious relics, the tears of the Savior. By whom and in what manner they were preserved, the pilgrims did not inquire. Their genuineness was vouched by the Christians of the Holy Land, and that was sufficient. Tears of the Virgin Mary and tears of St. Peter were also to be had, carefully enclosed in little caskets which the pious might wear in their bosoms. After the tears, the next most precious relics were drops of the blood of Jesus and the martyrs, and the milk of the Virgin Mary. Hair and toenails were also in great repute and were sold at extravagant prices. Thousands of pilgrims annually visited Palestine in the 11th and 12th centuries to purchase pretended relics for the home market. The majority of them had no other means of subsistence than the profits thus obtained. Many a nail cut from the filthy foot of some unscrupulous ecclesiastic was sold at a diamond's price within 6 months after its severance from its parent toe, upon the supposition that it had once belonged to a saint or an apostle. Peter's toes were uncommonly prolific, for there were nails enough in Europe at the time of the Council of Clermont to have filled a sack, all of which were devoutly believed to have grown on the sacred feet of that great apostle. Some of them are still shown in the Cathedral of Aix-la-Chapelle. The pious come from a distance of 100 German miles to feast their eyes upon them. At Port-Royal in Paris is kept with great care a thorn, which the priests of that seminary assert to be one of the identical thorns that bound the holy head of the Son of God. How it came there and by whom it was preserved has never been explained. This is the famous thorn, celebrated in the long dissensions of the Jansenists and the Molinists, and which worked the miraculous cure upon Mademoiselle Perrier. By merely kissing it, she was cured of a disease of the eyes of long standing. What traveler is unacquainted with the Santa Scala, or Holy Stairs, at Rome? They were brought from Jerusalem along with the true cross by the Empress Helen and were taken from the house which, according to popular tradition, was inhabited by Pontius Pilate. They are said to be the steps which Jesus ascended and descended when brought into the presence of the Roman Emperor. They are held in the greatest veneration at Rome. It is sacrilegious to walk upon them. The knees of the faithful must alone touch them in ascending or descending, and that only after the pilgrims have reverentially kissed them. Europe still swarms with these religious relics. There is hardly a Roman Catholic church in Spain, Portugal, Italy, France, or Belgium without one or more of them, Even the poorly endowed churches of the villages boast the possession of miraculous thigh bones of the innumerable saints of the Romish calendar. Aix-la-Chapelle is proud of the veritable chasse, or thigh bone of Charlemagne, which cures lameness. Hull has a thigh bone of the Virgin Mary. Spain has 7 or 8, all said to be undoubted relics. Brussels, at one time preserved, and perhaps does now, the teeth of St. Gudule. The faithful who suffered from the toothache had only to pray, look at them, and be cured. Some of these holy bones have been buried in different parts of the continent. After a certain lapse of time, water is said to ooze from them, which soon forms a spring and cures all the diseases of the faithful. It is curious to remark the avidity manifested in all ages and in all countries to obtain possession of some relic of any persons who have been much spoken of, even for their crimes. When William Longbeard, leader of the populace of London in the reign of Richard I, was hanged at Smithfield, the utmost eagerness was shown to obtain a hair from his head or a shred from his garments. Women came from Essex, Kent, Suffolk, Sussex, and all the surrounding counties to collect the mould at the foot of his gallows. A hair of his beard was believed to preserve from evil spirits, and a piece of his clothes from aches and pains. In more modern days, a similar avidity was shown to obtain a relic of the luckless Masaniello, the fisherman of Naples. After he had been raised by mob favor to a height of power more despotic than monarch ever wielded, he was shot by the same populace in the streets as if he had been a mad dog. His headless trunk was dragged through the mire for several hours and cast at nightfall into the city ditch. On the morrow, the tide of popular feeling turned once more in his favor. His corpse was sought, arrayed in royal robes and buried magnificently by torchlight in the cathedral, 10,000 armed men and as many mourners attending at the ceremony. The fisherman's dress which he had worn was rent into shreds by the crowd, to be preserved as relics. The door of his hut was pulled off its hinges by a mob of women and eagerly cut up into small pieces to be made into images, caskets, and other mementos. The scanty furniture of his poor abode became of more value than the adornments of a palace. The ground he had walked upon was considered sacred, and being collected in small phials was sold at its weight in gold and worn in the bosom as an amulet. Almost as extraordinary was the frenzy manifested by the populace of Paris on the execution of the atrocious Marchioness de Brinvilliers. There were grounds for the popular wonder in the case of Masaniello, who was unstained with personal crimes, but the career of Madame de Brinvilliers was of a nature to excite no other feelings than disgust and abhorrence. She was convicted of poisoning several persons and sentenced to be burned in the Place de Grève and to have her ashes scattered to the winds. On the day of her execution, the populace, struck by her gracefulness and beauty, inveighed against the severity of her sentence. Their pity soon increased to admiration, and ere evening she was considered a saint. Her ashes were industriously collected. Even the charred wood which had aided to consume her was eagerly purchased by the populace. Her ashes were thought to preserve from witchcraft. In England, many persons have a singular love for the relics of thieves and murderers or other great criminals. The ropes with which they have been hanged are very often bought by collectors at a guinea per foot. Great sums were paid for the rope which hanged Dr. Dodd, and for those more recently which did justice upon Mr. Fauntleroy for forgery, and on Thurtle for the murder of Mr. Weir, the murder of Maria Martin by Corder in the year 1828, excited the greatest interest all over the country. People came from Wales and Scotland, and even from Ireland, to visit the barn where the body of the murdered woman was buried. Every one of them was anxious to carry away some memorial of his visit. Pieces of the barn door, tiles from the roof, and above all the clothes of the poor victim were eagerly sought after. A lock of her hair was sold for 2 guineas, and the purchaser thought himself fortunate in getting it so cheaply. So great was the concourse of people to visit the house in Camberwell Lane, where Greenacre murdered Hannah Brown in 1837, that it was found necessary to station a strong detachment of police on the spot. The crowd was so eager to obtain a relic of the house of this atrocious criminal that the police were obliged to employ force to prevent the tables and chairs and even the doors from being carried away. In earlier times, a singular superstition was attached to the hand of a criminal who had suffered execution. It was thought that by merely rubbing the dead hand on the body, the patient afflicted with the king's evil would be instantly cured. The executioner at Newgate formerly derived no inconsiderable revenue from this foolish practice. The possession of the hand was thought to be of still greater efficacy in the cure of diseases and the prevention of misfortunes. In the time of Charles II, as much as 10 guineas was thought a small price for one of these disgusting relics. When the maniac Tom, or Courtney, was shot in the spring of 1838, the relic hunters were immediately in motion to obtain a memento of so extraordinary an individual. His long black beard and hair, which were cut off by the surgeons, fell into the hands of his disciples, by whom they were treasured with the utmost reverence. A lock of his hair commanded a great price, not only amongst his followers, but among the more wealthy inhabitants of Canterbury and its neighborhood. The tree against which he fell when he was shot was stripped of all its bark by the curious, while a letter with his signature to it was paid for in gold coins, and his favorite horse became as celebrated as its master. Parties of ladies and gentlemen went to Boughton from a distance of 150 miles to visit the scene of that fatal affray, and stroke on the back the horse of the Mad Knight of Malta. If a strict watch had not been kept over his grave for months, the body would have been disinterred and the bones carried away as memorials. Among the Chinese, no relics are more valued than the boots which have been worn by an upright magistrate. In Davis's interesting description of the Empire of China, we are informed that whenever a judge of unusual integrity resigns his situation, the people all congregate to do him honor. If he leaves the city where he has presided, the crowd accompany him from his residence to the gates, where his boots are drawn off with great ceremony to be preserved in the Hall of Justice. Their place is immediately supplied by a new pair, which in their turn are drawn off to make room for others before he has worn them 5 minutes, it being considered sufficient to consecrate them that he should have merely drawn them on. Among the most favorite relics of modern times in Europe are Shakespeare's mulberry tree, Napoleon's willow, and the table at Waterloo on which the emperor wrote his dispatches. Snuff boxes of Shakespeare's mulberry tree are comparatively rare, though there are doubtless more of them in the market than were ever made of the wood planted by the great bard. Many a piece of alien wood passes under this name. The same may be said of Napoleon's table at Waterloo. The original has long since been destroyed, and a round dozen of counterfeits along with it. Many preserve the simple stick of wood. Others have them cut into brooches and every variety of ornament. But by far the greater number prefer them as snuff boxes. In France they are made into bonbonnières, and are much esteemed by the many thousands whose cheeks still glow and whose eyes still sparkle at the name of Napoleon. Bullets from the field of Waterloo and buttons from the coats of the soldiers who fell in the fight are still favorite relics in Europe. But the same ingenuity which found new tables after the old one was destroyed has cast new bullets for the curious. Many a one who thinks himself the possessor of a bullet which aided in giving peace to the world on that memorable day is the owner of a dump, first extracted from the ore a dozen years afterwards. Let all lovers of genuine relics look well to their money before they part with it to the Cicerone that swarm in the village of Waterloo. Few travelers stopped at the lonely Isle of St. Helena without cutting a twig from the willow that drooped over the grave of Napoleon prior to the removal of the body by the government of Louis-Philippe. Many of them have since been planted in different parts of Europe and have grown into trees as large as their parent. Relic hunters who are unable to procure a twig of the original are content with one of these. Several of them are growing in the neighborhood of London. But in relics, as in everything else, there is the use and the abuse. The undoubted relics of great men or great events will always possess attractions for the thinking and refined. There are few who would not join with Cowley in the extravagant wish introduced in his lines, written while sitting in a chair made of the remains of the ship in which Sir Francis Drake sailed round the world. And I myself, who now love quiet too, almost as much as any chair can do, would yet a journey take, an old wheel of that chariot to see, which Phaeton so rashly break.
This has been a Gildan Audio production. For more affordable, life-changing audio programs, visit our website at gildanmedia.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.